Hello and welcome to Partners for Progressive Israel podcast. I'm your host, Nicole Cooper, recording out of Jerusalem. If you've been listening to my previous podcasts, you'll know I've been exploring the topic of forced displacement of Palestinians by Israeli authorities and settler groups through the form of demolition and house evictions. Today we're going to be talking about Susia, a village in the South Hebron Hills. The entire village has a demolition order against it. Susia is located in the southernmost part of the West Bank, about 15 kilometers south of Hebron. So first, just a quick summary of what's happening in Susia. On May 5, 2015, Israel's High Court of Justice ruled to allow the army to demolish the entire village of Susia and expel its residents, numbering around 340 men, women, and children, to Area A of the occupied territories. Considered a highly unusual move, the court refused to grant an interim order freezing the implementation of the demolition until the court hears a discussion on the appeal to authorize the village. The opposition of the state to the interim order request suggests that it intends to demolish the village in the near future. I'm now going to read to you a rather lengthy but very good legal status update about Susia from Rabbis for Human Rights. Susia is an old Palestinian village of farmers and shepherds. The village residents from 25 different families lived in ancient caves on land they owned for decades. In 1983, the settlement of Susia was erected on state land near the residents' farming lands. In 1986, the Israeli Defense Force, or IDF, expropriated the land of the Palestinian village in favor of an archaeological site. Today, the settlers manage a site open to visitors for an entry fee. Aside from five caves showing artifacts, dozens of other caves stand empty. In addition, settlers built an unauthorized outpost within the archaeological site. As a result of expropriating the village land, the residents dispersed and most of them moved into the handful of caves that were scattered on their farmlands. In 2001, when the Second Intifada broke out, the army destroyed the caves, structures, and the water cisterns. The residents petitioned the High Court of Justice in an expedited procedure against the violent attempt to expel them. The High Court of Justice issued an interim order to stop the destruction, but did not order planning procedures for the village. In the absence of caves, the residents had to build temporary structures. The village has no outline plan, and therefore it is difficult to receive building permits based on Plan RJ5. All attempts to obtain building permits, appeals, and requests of amnesty were rejected. Today, the village has 100 structures that serve about 340 residents. In 2010, the residents with Rabbis for Human Rights petitioned the High Court of Justice to grant them access to their agricultural land and evict the agricultural takeover of part of their land by settlers. As a result of the petition, the army signed a number of closure orders against Israelis only. The response by the Susia settlers, a petition to expedite the demolition of the village. In 2012, in an act of revenge against the residents' petition, Susia settlers, along with the right-wing organization Regavim, petitioned the court to expedite the demolition orders in the village of Susia. The court rejected both petitions in light of the state's response that it was handling both demands reasonably. And indeed, as a result of the settlers' petition, dozens more demolition orders were distributed in the village. Village residents submitted to the civil administration five alternative outline plans for their village in its present location. It was rejected. In late 2013, the Civil Administration Planning Committee rejected the plan on unreasonable grounds, such as a small number of residents in the village, their connection with the town of Yatza, the feasibility of the plan in terms of construction and infrastructure costs, the quality of the services presented provided to the village, and the need for infrastructures that would allow the female residents to advance in the labor market, etc. Indulgently, the residents were offered to plan for themselves on state land in an alternative location. In early 2014, the residents and Rabbis for Human Rights petitioned the court against the reasonableness of the decision to reject the plan. They argue that the state is responsible for the fate of the residents of Susia and is responsible to arrange their living on their land, especially in light of the village's unique history. Along with the petition, we submitted a motion for an interim order to freeze the realization of the demolition orders against the village because their execution would obviate the hearing of the petition and render it moot. For a year, the state asked to postpone its response to the motion for an interim order while undertaking to freeze the realization of the demolition orders. In March 2015, the state submitted its objection to the motion for an interim order. As a rule, the state agrees to interim orders on demolition petitions, but this time, exceptionally, the state opposed the motion. The state explained its objection by saying the petition must be rejected out of hand because, on the supervision level, the state acted within its powers without prejudice, whereas the residents of the village took the law into their own hands and continued to build on violation orders in lack of good faith. On the planning level, argued the state, the village has no feasibility or justification for the reasons detailed in the decision to reject the plan, as well as because there was no Palestinian village at the archaeological site. At the very most, there were seasonal residences of a handful of families, and in any case, the area was legally expropriated in 1986. In response, the petitioners argued, among other things, that the state's objection reveals the lack of good faith in its offer to allow planning at an alternative site because a new planning process to which they object would take years and meanwhile people will have no place to live. We further argue that the state has increased responsibility because it expropriated the village area, and we presented affidavits and photos from life in the caves before the expropriation. In May 2015, the court rejected the motion for an interim order since the residents had taken the law into their own hands during the years. The judge noted the state's willingness to examine the possibility of advancing planning at alternative site as long as a preliminary planning would be done by the petitioners. The judge's decision is de facto permission for the state to realize the demolition orders in the village that has stood in its present location for 30 years. It also legalizes the forced transfer of protected persons in an occupied territory, a forbidden act under international law, which is defined as a war crime. The village of Susia is threatened by imminent demolition, and presently the state refuses to promise not to realize the demolition orders until the main hearing on the petition. The hearing of the main petition was scheduled for August 3rd, in 2015. Those clips are from a demonstration in Susia on May 16th. Locals from different popular struggles from all of the West Bank, Israeli activists, and probably some internationals gathered in Susia to demonstrate solidarity with the villagers. The demonstration also fell one day after the commemoration of the Nakba of 1948, when an estimated 700,000 Palestinians were expelled from their own land and hundreds of Palestinian towns and villages were destroyed. The sound and description is from Atouani Project. Atouani is a Palestinian village of about 250 to 300 people in the South Hebron Hills. The residents and residents of surrounding villages nonviolently resist Israeli settler violence and military occupation by continuing to live and work on their land. Farmers organize nonviolent direct actions in coordination with Israeli and international activists. Children, teachers, and local residents organize solidarity marches to support the children in the region who face settler violence and harassment on their journey to school. The South Hebron Hills Popular Resistance Committee coordinates a nonviolent resistance in the region and is connected to other popular resistance committees in other regions of the West Bank. As I mentioned, the sound and description came from a YouTube video called Atouani Project, but I can't quite figure out who to ask for permission to use it. So I figure if I've cited them, and at cpt.org is a Christian Peacemakers Teams where my description of Atouani is coming from. If anyone has an issue with me using the sound and description, please let me know. And apologies. Okay, so now I'm here with Robin Levy. Robin is a writer, poet, and active member of the All That's Left collective. She's lived in Jerusalem for almost 2 years. Before she was in Cairo, and before that she was acquiring a Bachelor of Political Science from Northwestern University near Chicago. First of all, hello, and thanks for being here, and also thanks for listening to all you listeners. So first question, how was your first time in Susia? What did you think of it, and who did you go with?
Hello. So I first went to Susia on a learning day that was organized by the collective All That's Left and also Breaking the Silence. And it was essentially mostly us hearing from a longtime activist named Almiel Varde, who's a member of Ta'ayush, which is an organization that has been involved in the South Hebron Hills for the past 10 years, if not more. Basically, their purpose is to go with Palestinians who are no longer allowed access to their lands or who have trouble accessing their lands, and to interact as a buffer, essentially, between the Palestinians and the military and settlers sometimes when they show up, so that these different families from these different villages are able to work their land and do other such things. And in Susia, they've been directly involved also in connecting them with other international organizations and so on that help them to build press, because Susia has faced demolition many times previously. On this first trip, I, having never been to the South Hebron Hills before, was first of all just taking in the landscape, taking in the scenery. It is very interesting because you see how there are both settlements that have very developed homes, very developed road systems, and then you see these kind of remnants of Palestinian villages that are very rudimentary, with tents, with their sheep. And Susia is very much like this. And you can see that there's been donations from different international organizations, and there's, you know, that's where I think a lot of the tents come, either from those organizations or from the Palestinian Authority. What Amiel told us is essentially that the group of people who now live in what is called Susia had previously lived in another area called Susia that now has been made into an archaeological site after the Palestinians living there were evicted. And the site is where there was an ancient synagogue that now has, I guess, a visitor center. But Amiel also mentioned that within the area that was deemed the archaeological site, there are some outposts. So outposts are settlements that even under Israeli law are illegal. So these are people who are, you know, trying to expand or, like, sometimes live in places where technically they're not allowed to be living, which is the similar claim that's being put on Susia, which is that the lands that they're on, they don't have permits to build, and they're not part of what is called a master plan, which the civil administration, like the local organizing council in the area, which is essentially organizes the different settlements and connecting them, so that, like, they often don't allow permission for Palestinians to build, even when it is sought, and they also will hold it against these villages for not having these permits as well. So this is this current case that's happening in Susia now is being argued in part that the people who live in this area that is now called Susia, what was previously the agricultural lands that the Palestinians would come to work the land for their own livelihoods, that these lands don't constitute a village, and also that the sort of, like, livelihoods that they're able to have by working these lands is not as viable as the lives that they could have in the city of Yatta, where they're being kind of asked to really relocate themselves to. It's interesting because this legal argument does have a certain kind of agenda behind it that's a bit transparent. You feel that obviously there are real arguments behind some of these issues in terms of, you know, rural life versus city life, but that kind of law being imposed upon people is not imposed, from my impression, equally throughout the Palestinian territories. And for certain settlements that are also very rudimentary and trying to live in some ways like, you know, people lived in the times of the Bible, there's something also to that that's a certain way of rural life. And so the question really is, and comes down to, is whether the law is being applied disproportionately to certain groups, i.e. the Palestinians who live in these areas. So that was kind of my introduction to Susia via Amiel, via Ta'ayush. Ta'ayush, by the way, means living in partnership, which is the idea behind this group. It's an organization that, you know, aims to be in solidarity in these issues with the Palestinians who need sometimes, you know, Rabbis for Human Rights, for example, provides legal counsel for the people in Susia. They have to work within the Israeli system, and to do that, not having necessarily the access to resources, this gives them that access. So I think that's kind of an introduction to what's going on and how I saw it. I mean, my reactions were kind of obviously both one of shock and a bit of dismay at seeing that essentially these group of people who have been evicted multiple times in their past are going to again have to relocate and again, like, you know, essentially start over, which is something that I can't really imagine because I've never had to do, I mean, not in the same degree as what they'll be going through. And at the same time, of course, I want to remain skeptical of all of the narratives that I'm being told because I'm mostly interested in knowing what actually is happening, what's true, what are the different implications, what parties are involved. And it's clear that this particular case in Susia has become a case that a lot of people know about, that does get a lot of press, and that is seen, I think, for many as kind of representative of greater problems in the area.
So as you mentioned, there are settler outposts nearby, and the village is set up away from its original spot, but still on the agricultural lands that the people privately own. Can you give us a visual description of what it looks like and what the settler's spot looks like and how there's like army outposts on each hill and these kind of things?
Yeah, so I can tell you what I've seen, which isn't actually all of Susia, because given that they're living on their agricultural lands, their homes are now very spread out. So you wouldn't go there and see, you know, the 350 people that is Susia. You see, you know, a few tents. It's this very beige kind of ground with, like, rocks and gravel. Not gravel like the way we think of gray gravel, but just a light beige gravel and peppered with some green. But you only see the real green when you kind of go down the hill. For example, when we first arrived in Susia, you see a sign saying, like, "Welcome to Susia." And there's a tent. There was a tent with a line of poetry, actually, from Mahmoud Darwish that really stuck out to me. The line that says, you know, "On this land is what makes life worth living." And you keep walking, you see these kind of more, maybe like advanced tents that have like, in some cases, I think that there was like the containers of water sitting around because they're not connected to the water grid. And you keep walking, and one of the times that I was there, we walked down to see Nasser, who is a resident of Susia and an activist who's very involved in B'Tselem, and he is involved in a lot of advocacy work on the behalf of Susia. And he was showing us the area that he actually works, the part of the land that's, you know, really the agricultural land. And it's very close. We walked down the hill, and it's in a valley, and we could see a little, you know, olive grove and an area where, you know, he'd been harvesting. And on that land, it's very, very close to a new outpost. I forget the name of the settlement that it's, you know, connected to, but it's essentially, as the hill goes up on the other side, it's right there. To the extent that I walked over to look at the lands with Nasser, and he was pointing out where actually the day before some settlers had come down and begun working land and actually begun cutting up some of the branches on the trees until someone noticed and they were stopped. And this is kind of the concern of if they are, you know, displaced off of the land, that for some of them who actually only come there when it is time to harvest and when it is time to work the land, they would fear that if they're not actually present and living on the land during that time, that the facts on the ground could change if, say, more outposts are built in the areas that actually are technically their land. And when I walked up and was approaching this outpost, it was like a gazebo, which I actually believe had a pool in it, which is so interesting given how difficult it is for many of the Palestinians in this area to get water, that they spend... one of the other members of Daesh was telling us they spend so much more on a small amount of water than it's something like in the really far out areas, like 10 times what we might be spending in Jerusalem, or even much more than what Palestinians would spend in Ramallah. And so as I approached this gazebo and this like little tent, the soldiers actually approached me and told me that I'm not allowed to go further. And they just said because it was problematic. which I think is that obviously they don't want any sort of provocation. And, I mean, my intention really wasn't to provoke. I just wanted to see how close and the proximity there is between these outposts and these lands. And I honestly am curious, you know, for the people who are living in these outposts, if they're aware exactly of what, you know, they're doing, in the sense of, I think that probably some have the intention to really continue settling, that they know that other people have claims to these lands, but they don't consider them to be legitimate, whether it be for historical or religious reasons. But I also think that, you know, there's many levels of responsibility going on here, because there's also the local civil administration, there's also the role of the soldiers as they play in kind of mediating in some ways, but also often maybe implementing law in a way that they're being told to implement law, which, you know, from the viewpoint of the Palestinians is unjust, that the law isn't being implemented equally for them as it is for the others who are living in this area. So for me, that was very interesting to observe and to see in person.
So speaking of the law being implemented differently, if the place that the people are living now in Susia isn't on the actual site anymore, which was the original excuse for moving them, mm-hmm. and now they're, you know, in their agricultural land, as we've talked about before, a little in this and in previous episodes, that acquiring permits is a very hard process, and what that ends up resulting in is more demolition, because then it becomes an illegal activity to build. Can we talk about this a little bit, about like why are we actually moving them again?
Right. Yeah. So the reasons given, and this is where I think that Susia is, the reason it's so representative is it has all of these different issues going on at play. So originally there really was, you know, an ancient synagogue on this historical site. So that's its own question of, is that a legitimate reason to move people off? You know, for myself, I sometimes see it as legitimate, like in terms of preservation when I'm in America or in other places, when I see synagogues that are preserved. So what about in a place that's, you know, as the settlers who live there often might call it, they call it Judea and Samaria. This is historical Jewish lands. So for them, that claim is of importance both historically and religiously. But then I think about the current situation of where the residents of Susia now are. And it does seem to me that, okay, even if you could say there was legitimacy to the original claim, why would you again want to demolish their homes and move them when clearly, you know, at the very least, the state does not seem to deny that they work the land there? I mean, part of their claim says that they only come there for a period of time, which is true for some of them, though not for the majority of them, that some of them do live in Yatta and come there because that's where their land and their livelihood is. Which is significant given that Yatta actually has a very high level of unemployment and poverty. So this other claim that says that they could have better lives just living in Yatta, you know, is perhaps also suspect. And given that Yatta also is a Palestinian city under the authority of the Palestinian Authority is in control of that area, it's interesting that, you know, Israel has this ability to displace people from a land that, because it's Area C, can now be told to go to a different area that actually isn't even, well, is under their jurisdiction, but it also isn't under their jurisdiction. So I think all of these issues kind of come together at this place. And in terms of the law that's being implemented now for, like, the reasons that they're giving for moving them off, I mean, like I said before, it has to do with this kind of rural living that they... I think in the arguments, the press release and the legal documents that Rabbis for Human Rights have released show that, like, the arguments that are being made make reference specifically to kind of this scattered living, that it's not really a city, it's not really, you know, legitimate, essentially, that it couldn't be connected to the electricity and water grids, that there's a lot of obstacles, essentially, in integrating it into the master plan. And, you know, I do think that given that the residents of Susia themselves had hired someone to create a master plan for their area and have done this work, and that's actually what the original, I think, appeal and rejection of the appeal was, or the appeal was about this being rejected, their master plan, that, like, clearly, you know, there's a way to resolve this that doesn't rest in the current extreme way that's being implemented. And so that's my feeling as someone who wants to write and act on behalf of people living there, that I don't think that moving them off is the best option. And I also don't think that it's consistent or should be consistent with how laws are being applied in this region, both be it for the Palestinian residents, but also for the Israeli residents.
So there's two interesting things in that discussion there that aren't so much on the factual side, but more on the like philosophical side. One about why activists tap into what they do tap into. Like, okay, yeah, it has all these intersections, all these different things going on. Oh, wow, it has this issue, but then what are we forgetting? What are we leaving behind? And, like, how do we actually pick what we pick to work on? And what does that mean for the people that are left out? And then also the other question about archaeology. What is relevant? What is not? How do we feel as, like, activist Jews, if we will, about, you know, reconciling with compassion for people and with archaeology? And, again, moreover, how do we think about tourists coming to a settlement? Like, how does that enable the occupation? Like, it's not like tourists would come visit just like a suburb style settlement with nothing interesting to see, but they're going to come if there's like a synagogue and like, wow, that really proves like that Jews were here and that we belong here and that Palestinians don't. You know, it's a very complicated thing. So maybe you want to answer the archaeology stuff first and we'll talk about the activist stuff.
Yeah. So I do think a lot about, like, settlement tourism, and why is that necessarily tourism, first of all? And I do think also when you value history versus, what, like, what's going on now, that there has to be a balance that is struck, and that, like, you have to, if you're going to move people out of a place in their modern-day homes, you need to ensure that you're giving them basic necessities wherever it is they're going, because you do not get to ruin people's lives for the sake of preserving history. I mean, as much as I really believe in preservation of history, and actually my sister works at a historical foundation, and, like, this is, it's, like, not something I take lightly. I really, really value it. And I really understand also for people who are religious that, like, I really get that connection that you want to be in the place, you feel something maybe holy in a certain place. I've felt that in many places in my life, and I don't want to take that away from other people, but I think they still really need to keep other people as well in mind. That if it's this balance of one person's needs versus another, you really need to feel like both people's needs are being considered. And right now, I mean, given that even just in their agricultural lands, they're wanting to move the people of Susia off, it's like, clearly, I feel like this respect is lacking. I mean, they can't give respect also to the tradition of how they've lived their lives with this kind of grazing and the having the sheep and having lots of lands on which to work. I mean, that is a way of life, and that is the way of life that in these lands was lived for a very long time, and I have, you know, great respect for it. And when I go with the Ayush, and I'm a part of that and witnessing it, it's something that I feel actually resonates with me very deeply. And but it's not to say that it wouldn't resonate with me if those people were Jewish. Like, obviously, it doesn't matter whether they're Jewish or Palestinian. Either group should have the right to be able to live that way. But right now, the people who are Jewish, who are there trying to live, are often doing it in a way that is unfortunately creating these negative consequences for the other people who actually lived there before.
Is there any sense of if the settlers that are there actually care about the land, about the archaeology, or if they're just kind of there because they're there, it's a place to go, or is there any, like, reverence for that spot of land?
Right.
Do you know
this? I think, I don't know for sure, but I do believe I asked that question to the, like, longtime members of Daayush, what their sense of, and the impression I got, and we didn't go into any real deep conversation, is that they are religious. You know, these are smaller outposts, smaller settlements that have kind of the more ideological individuals living in them, whereas, like, some other settlements really are just places people go for, you know, a variety of other reasons, but not necessarily ideological, not necessarily religious. But in this place, I think that religion at least is something they express, being kind of their connection to that land. And to me, that's, you know, that's totally legitimate, actually, to feel a connection to land. But I think that there's actually a rabbi who I had read about before I came to Israel and really hoped to meet, but unfortunately is no longer with us, named Menachem Fruman, who has this great quote that he says, you know, there's, when you're getting married, for example, there's an idea that you're going to possess your partner, possess your wife, possess your husband, but this is wrong, because the idea is actually that you're going to become absorbed by them, and this is the same attitude that we should have towards land, that there is, you know, one perspective in which you are possessing something, and it is yours, and you own it, and you are the only person who has a right to it, and also the only history you can see is your own in that place, and then there's the absorption of land, which is recognizing that land is evolving and changing, and goes through many incarnations of residence, and even for the Palestinians who live there, you know, in this particular land that they're living on, they were previously moved from another place, so they haven't been there for hundreds and hundreds of years, but they definitely have a connection to that land, and they definitely, you know, even if they've been moved there in the past, like, 50 years, that's not to say that then they should be moved again. I mean, this is what cycles of displacement, what cycles of movement do we want to create for people, and what is the ultimate intention? And I think that there's a multiplicity of intentions in the part of the settlers living there that, like, really deserves our consideration, because I do think there's this part which is, you know, their own personal belief and perspective towards that land and their desire to be there. But I think that they can be there without possessing the land, and they can be there while still absorbing and respecting the other narratives that exist on that land and allowing other people who are living there to continue the life and the lifestyles that they've, you know, previously been living.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, they can't even really preserve what they had been living before, because they had caves that they were living in traditionally, but then, or traditionally, as far as we can see, back to 1830. But then those were covered by the army several decades ago. So that's what led them to having the kind of shack shanty style housing, which is now illegal, which is now being moved.
Right.
So
yeah. No, exactly this. And there are a few of, I think, the villages left in the firing zone, the area around Susia, where people do still live in caves. And those are people who are, like, trying to remain in their place of, you know, this sort of lifestyle. And it's really hard. I mean, it's not, you know, there's many, I think, obstacles in terms of that way of living already. And then for, like, in the entire state to seemingly be against you continuing that way of life, I mean, this it just comes back to this thing of they need to be offered possible alternatives, but then they also need to be given a choice in terms of what they want to do, because that's, you know, this thing of dignity and allowing people to, like, express themselves. And I think that that's something that is afforded a lot of, you know, Jews in this country in general, where there is this disparity between, like, self-expression and self-recognition is totally being empowered and allowed in Judaism, which is great. And as someone who, you know, doesn't see that in a lot of other places, is appreciative of it, but it needs to not be then done, you know, in a way that takes away from other people's ability to express their own voice and their own right and their thoughts and their identity.
Are we able to move then into the question of, like, what we pick?
Ah, yeah. So that's also a really great question. In terms of, you know, right now, I only know about Susia and I'm interested in it, in part because organizations that I also was interested in have led me to be interested in it. So I'll completely admit it's not a place I organically went into the Palestinian territories and somehow stumbled upon and found on my own. And I wonder about that because other experiences I've had in Israel have been, and Palestine, have been somewhat more organic in terms of the issues I've become passionate about just through making, you know, normal kind of day-to-day connections and befriending people and hearing their stories. And so in Susia, I feel I have a personal connection because I've been there, but I'm not somehow being given this, like, deep insight of knowing anyone there really well and really understanding the intricacies of what's going on. And that makes me feel some hesitation in speaking in any way as, like, deeply knowledgeable or also as very, like, certain in terms of what I think should be done. The other part of me is this more increasingly activist side that says, okay, you think and you acknowledge and you consider a lot of things that happen in the world, and when you're in proximity to them, that next push of actually, you know, being part of action is something that should and, like, can be done. And so given that I've recently become involved in a group, like, in All That's Left, and I volunteer with Rabbis for Human Rights and also have, like, gone along with the Ayush a few times, I'm beginning to see how these organizations function and at what point they see that the need for action is a necessity. So I think in Susia, I'm not sure if the need there is like greater than in other places, but it certainly exists. And therefore, like, you know, it's there, and that's another question, is I am not yet at a place where I can say this is where we need to act, and like I know. So I have to trust that other activists and other individuals involved in these organizations are leading me in a good direction. And I have, you know, part of me totally tries to be trusting, and part of me totally tries to be skeptical. So I'm not yet finished in terms of trying to understand what's going on here. But I certainly feel that the current actions, for example, that all that's left is taking in regards to these issues are very positive and hopefully very productive, at least also as, you know, showing to the Palestinians that live there that, okay, look, here are individuals who also happen to be Jewish who are trying to, at the very least, listen and understand your perspective on this place, and also trying to act in a way that can give, you know, respect to that. And that, for me, like, is what's positive about this current, reaction to what's going on. Because I see people who actually really do want to act and want to know how exactly to act. And, you know, right now, our options are often creating international pressure and being a presence and participating in a way that allows us to be knowledgeable and then share those stories as much as we are able.
It's so tricky because everything here feels so urgent. And, you know, it's like if you spend a week defending one family from being demolished, you find out that, like, in Silwan, 4 houses were demolished in 1 week. You know, it's like,
yeah.
Ah.
No, and but so it's so interesting you say that, because I feel this kind of all the time of like, where should my priorities lie and where should my focus be on? And I've had the experience of a rabbi I know here who I actually have great respect for and like find him to be a really inspiring person and really thoughtful and interesting, even though, you know, he comes from a very different Jewish background than my own, but he once said to me something that I thought was very interesting, is that he didn't feel like I was very interested in, you know, areas of injustice within the Jewish world, and I kind of, like, I didn't really so much react then, but my ultimate reaction was thinking that I've grown up very much with those kind of narratives and perspective and that involvement, that back home in America, I used to be involved in issues that related to social justice and Judaism. And here, even though I do also think I need to continue and I'm trying to become more educated about those issues as well, I think that there's such a pressing need to be aware of the Palestinian situation, because there are many Israelis who are knowledgeable, there are also a large number who are not. And there are a large number of Americans I know back home that are in a similar state, that they are not aware of the reality and the current situation here. And so it's as you said, tricky. And I, you know, also want to act in places where I have the greatest insight in some ways, because that allows me to know that what I'm doing actually can be, you know, can solve a situation instead of making it more complicated or worse. And I'm always keeping these things in mind, but it's an ongoing thought process.
And so what does All That's Left Collective have in the magical brainstorming pot for Susia?
Previously, members of the collective went out to Susia 2 or so weeks ago to participate in a march where the Palestinians there were marching from one part of Susia, area that was now considered Susia, to another part, and then also actually marched towards where Susia used to be located. This march was just to show a response to the demolition orders being kind of, or not being essentially rejected, which is what happened recently, and which is why they're now living every day with the possibility that the demolition order could be implemented and then they would lose their homes. And in addition to going out and continuing to spread information about what's happening there, we've organized a larger action, which actually we had already been planning on before all of this happened in Susia, but now obviously we're acknowledging it within the action, because it'll be a day, 2 days, June 12th and 13th, where a group of now over 60, maybe close to 70 activists will be coming out and participating in the action and hopefully having some learning as well. And the idea will be to be paving a road near an area, a village called Bir Elid, which is currently their only, in the case of a medical emergency, in the case of any sort of emergency, the only option for them, the only hospital they can go to is in the nearby town of Yatta. And this is the road that would allow them to get there. So the road currently is in a state kind of disrepair, and we'll be coming and helping to repair it. In addition, we'll be doing some agricultural work in Susia, and they'll be hosting us in Susia. So I think that it's a pretty astounding action that will be taking place. It's kind of unprecedented, this large number of activists going and actually staying in the South Hebron Hills, and really better understanding kind of things as well from the inside, as we're going to be have some time to actually talk with people there. And for the people that are coming, it will be meaningful, and also I think for the Palestinian residents of Susia, it will be meaningful, and hopefully in some ways it can also continue this need for continued presence and continued press, so that there can be pressure to ensure that if the civil administration and the military are aware that people are paying attention, the truth is that this does kind of block them or gives them a reason to put off the demolition. And given that there still is an opportunity for appeal to go through in this particular case, the hope would be that, you know, it's possible that when there actually is the appeal, that you know, things will turn out differently.
How can listeners find out more about all that's left and about the action happening?
So if you go to our Facebook page, I think that's the easiest way. We have posted many times recently information about, you know, what we'll be doing that weekend. There's, I think, also a place you can still donate money if you want to support the action financially. And you can scroll through to find things written in the past that we have about different people's experiences. I wrote a piece recently about Susia that was published at the Jew School. One of my friends, Sophie, and another friend, Maury, both have blogs where they've written about their experiences in Da'ayush. There's many, many links that I think you could find on the Facebook page, so that is probably the best place to go. And if you want to read, you know, about Susia beyond obviously searching for it in the news and recent news, you can look on the Rabbis for Human Rights page. And I think also on YouTube, there are videos of actually the past demolitions, which can give you a sense of what that visually looks like, and give you a sense of just what the landscape looks like.
So as I mentioned in the intro, Robin is a poet. And so we're lucky enough that she's willing to share some poetry with us. And that'll be our closing, unless you have any more thoughts you want to say right now.
No, I think.
Okay.
Said everything.
Do you want to just give a brief introduction to the poem, and I'll just say bye to you now and thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me and speaking to me and, you know, listening. It's really appreciated.
So here we go.
Okay, so just to give people, because there's some context, I think, to this poem that would help it, I wrote this actually just after having gone on Da'ayush for the first time, and that day, I spent my morning with people who were shepherding. So we were surrounded by sheep, and it was a whole family working this one area of land that belonged to them. And there were actually many girls helping out, which I found to be really beautiful. And just, they were very friendly, obviously. They were the ones who came up to me and started talking to me, and we chatted a bit. So with that in mind, I make some reference to them here in my poem, and that might give you a sense of how these different snippets relate. In the flickering mirror of time, all events quiver in layers. I look for my reflection in Dabak, city stolen by Daesh in hopes of the apocalyptic end. Blunt knives drag on skin, man pushed off building for loving others with similar reflection. I can't see myself. Surah that rhyme with Talmud are not easily found in this pocket, tucked away only by media too self-obsessed with its own reaction or lack thereof to have a greater attention span than my microwave generation. The protesters in Baltimore paused to pick up trash. Don't give him a reason! As if they needed one before. Surrounded by sheep with yellow markers punched in their ears, a young woman, face covered to protect from brush, approaches me to offer leban. This is the only place I look and see myself staring back. Don't give him a reason, I think. Friend-turned-extremist tells me I've crossed the line, but point-in-time reflection incites me to hope the mirrored layer shall not call me dumb for expecting someone to reflect my mouth and hands moving beneath sheets, selfishly grasping at people in whom I see my own soul.